there. I'm Ann Davis. This is Desert Air, a show that gives a microphone to the often unheard voices in the Southern Nevada community. One of those voices is architect and UNLV associate professor Joshua Vermillion. When he's not teaching classes and doing research on technology's relationship with architectural design, he's sharing trippy, artificial intelligence-generated roomscapes on his Instagram. In this episode, Vermillion sits down with Desert Companion editor-at-large Scott Dickensheets to talk about the purpose of his Instagram page, his cautiously optimistic approach to AI, and the ethical complexities of using it to help design our future living spaces.
Well, thanks for being here, Josh.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So let's start with a big picture. Let's imagine a spectrum. At one end is extreme AI skeptic. At the other end is AI evangelist. Where would you locate yourself on that spectrum now? Has that position changed over time? And do you expect it to change in the future?
It really does seem like it's one or the other, right?
You right.
either love it or hate it, or I think what dominates the space is sort of alarmists on one end and then the folks trying to raise billions of dollars, billions with a B, right. Dollars to try to train the next model. So what I found is that I try to stay in the center. Now, whether I am or not, I think anybody else can judge, but that sort of sways back and forth. And really, I think it's a process of trying to understand or hone in on what's signal versus what's noise, right? There's a lot of noise in this space. It's a fast-moving technological space. And as a result, a lot of words get thrown around, oftentimes very carelessly. So I try to stay in the center where I am both excited about experimenting with these tools, but at the same time, you have to come at it with a critical point of view, a critical lens, ask some tough questions about it. And, you know, my questions are dealing primarily with my expertise, which is design architecture. You know, from there, I start to ask maybe different questions than artists or writers or others, right? We're kind of adjacent to each other, that we're all creatives. But at the same time, I do recognize that there are differences between these different disciplines that we belong to.
You're a professor of architecture at UNLV, but you've done work in non-academic settings for commercial, business, media companies. What are some of the experiences you've had there that have shaped your view of how AI is or isn't a good tool?
Indeed, I have been using these things outside of, let's say, my normal teaching and normal sort of scholarly pursuits like writing and getting publications out. So, but it has sort of, again, informed my creative work. You know, I've shown work throughout the world, London, Mumbai, the UAE, and other places. But I have worked with a lot of large companies as well. So that includes Microsoft, that includes Samsung, other fashion magazines, fashion brands like Harper's Bazaar and Elle magazines, et cetera. When it comes to the AI specific things, my work might involve basically images generated with AI. And again, that process is not just a black and white, but it's really about all the tools that I've traditionally used, all the workflows I've developed mm-hmm. over 10 years. All those tools have started to introduce and integrate features that are generated through machine learning as well.
And people in the audience who are interested in how you approach this idea have an easy place to look. You have a daily Instagram page that you post on, and you post these like speculative architectural spaces that you generate with AI, very often centerpiece by some sort of show-stopping design element. How did you come to do that, begin that project, and what are you trying to do with that?
Right. My take on this is ambassador or skeptic, you really need to have an informed opinion about these tools. And so trying to understand what they can and can't do is part of that. That became a daily posting. Every morning I'd wake up and sort of come up with whatever idea was in my head. And it's actually built quite an audience, surprisingly. So I use that space as a way to ask interesting questions or just simply show some of the interesting results that come out of, in this case, latent diffusion models, that, you know, going from text to images or from images to images. So I'm always sort of thinking about what kind of information do I pump into these AI models and what can they actually return. So it's kind of interesting to sort of have this give and take in this sort of extended conversation with folks who aren't necessarily designers or artists or architects and sort of hearing their feedback, right? The good, the bad, and sometimes the ugly.
What's the feedback you're getting?
I think people are trying to wrap their heads around what this means. AI, for a long time, sort of colloquially, we could say, is trying to get computers to do things like the human mind. And when you approach it from that standpoint, I think it really blew a lot of people away when they started seeing computers be able to write essays or to generate images that we thought was really primarily the human domain. The fact that they can generate such exquisitely rendered effects, spatial effects, lighting effects, textural and material effects, which are things that I'm really interested in pushing, trying to understand what kinds of things it can actually draw. Even though it has no idea what light or materials or textures even are. And so trying to, again, query the space between what is a very narrow, but still a sort of non-biological intelligence, how it understands our world, and how narrow that understanding is based on just its training data alone.
Bending back toward your day job as an architecture professor, how are these tools sort of working themselves into the profession?
Great question. I talk to architects all the time, and of course, I'm always trying to sort of understand how these things can be integrated into the next generation. When I teach, we have very careful conversations about these tools and how they can be useful, trying to understand them, trying to be able to critique them in the ways that we've always critiqued things, but at the same time, to try to make sure that they're not a crutch, a learning crutch, so to say, right? So that students aren't over-relying on them or not flexing the right intellectual muscles when it comes to design work. And so what we talk a lot about, and I introduce some of these tools in my design studios, for instance, is how these models can actually connect to some of their already developed workflows. So for instance, that they can sketch something in their sketchbook, take a snapshot of it, feed it into the model, and let the model start to riff off of this while they're doing more sketches. And so design has always been a feedback loop between the idea and the representation of the idea, making drawings and other visual representations of the idea in order to sort of develop, and then back to the drawing board, and then back to the representation, critique, reflection, and then back to the drawing board again. And so the affordance of any digital technology lately has been speed, right? Mm-hmm. So I think one of the critical things is how these technologies, in particular AI models, when integrated into the design process, can help speed up that feedback loop.
I know that some of the big emphases over in the department are sustainability and architecture for an arid environment, both of which are applicable here. Does AI have a role to play in how architecture addresses those and how students learn to address those issues?
Right now, I think what we're seeing is the first generation of AI tools. Again, they're very narrow. They rely primarily on the sorts of data that we actually have to use as training, a training data regimen. Things like the written word or things like all of the images we can find online, those become the sort of training data sets for these models. What will be really interesting is when we get to a second and third generation of these sorts of non-biological intelligence to help us design things, right? When they become much more niche and actually fine-tuned to some of the real concerns I think we have beyond representation or picture making, image making. Oftentimes when we think about wind and sun and light, those things are really computationally intensive to simulate and then begin to optimize for. And my hope is that these tools that evolve from machine learning can help us do that in a much more fluid way. And so we can begin, I think, to leverage computation in a much more sophisticated way to help us deal with, I think, some of these existential questions that we deal with. You know, design is always sort of a complex negotiation between a lot of competing objectives. Mm-hmm. And so my hope is that computation can help us understand where those sweet spots are and trying to optimize between a lot of competing constraints, like letting in light, but separating light from the heat, or having greater quality of life with vegetation, trees, and things like that, you know, making the public realm much more hospitable. And hopefully AI can help us with a model that can actually churn through lots and lots of data, can come up with solutions to help us solve these problems that maybe our human brains can't even grasp yet.
So it sounds like yours is primarily a pragmatic approach, AI as a tool. But do you foresee a time when a sufficiently complex, you know, AI like puts you out of business?
Right. Yeah, that's always the question, right? Like, I approach this from an architecture standpoint. It's a very complex process. And I would argue it's always going to be a highly transformative process that requires some human labor. Now, I can see, rather than being replaced, I can see productivity being increased, right? To a point where we start to eat away some of the labor involved, the amount of human labor needed to produce, let's say, a building, to go start from scratch, from an idea all the way to the drawings, to the finally built building. And so that's, I think, is something to be concerned about, right? You know, we talk in terms of efficiency. The efficiency is a big word right now. But at the end of the day, what that means is cutting out redundancy. And what we don't want to do is say, like, human labor is redundant, right? So I think from a lot of different standpoints, I would say, probably we're not going to ever be, at least not anytime soon, we're gonna worry about being replaced.
Is there a danger or a concern about, you know, the prevalence of AI-generated images, some used for good, you know, good purposes, some used for morally ambiguous purposes, as we've seen? Do you think there's any concern about, you know, AI estranging people from the creative process, people feeling like, you know, I can't trust imagery that I see anymore, especially as the technology sharpens and refines itself?
Yeah, that was a big concern with the most recent election, right? Mm-hmm. Is that we can now start to, you know, the term deepfakes has been around for a while, but the importance of trying to understand what's fake and what's real when we rely on things like photography or video and assume that they're telling some sort of truth to us, right? And I would argue that's always been a concern.
Deepfakes are proving to be an extraordinary political weapon that is difficult to defuse.
And then he had a press conference in the Rose Garden.
From fake videos of House Speaker Pelosi slurring her words to President Obama kicking a door he never kicked.
There's certain things to keep in mind here. One is that, I mean, technologies can always be used for good or bad, right? And in fact, I think that sort of holds a mirror up to us humans to sort of ask ourselves, well, how do we use these tools, right? And how do they augment the things that we should be doing and not augment the things that we probably shouldn't be doing, right? And AI, I think, is no different, right? And so it's up to us to sort of come to terms with the morals and ethics of these tools. And in fact, I would argue again, what the world needs now more than anything else is a liberal arts education. We need to be talking about these implications on labor, which is, we have experts right down the street at our universities that can help us wrap our heads around these issues, philosophical issues like ethics and morals, right? What does it mean when we scrape the internet for training data and then no one's compensated for that, right? Like, so, you know, there are a lot of issues for us to work through as a society. What I would hate, though, is for somebody to just sort of unequivocally sort of dismiss a technology that I think is really going to be transformative in the long run. I don't think we can do that. And in fact, I think if we need to have a seat at the table, then we need to engage, right? And we need to engage critically. I think I appreciate the critics out there.
So as you've been working with AI tools, has there been one or two instances where something that AI has done has surprised you while you were working with it?
When I first saw these tools, I thought they were nothing short of magic. And of course, when you start to use them, you realize that, you know, they're savants, right? They're sort of naively or almost idiotically sort of do whatever you ask for. They give you what you ask for, not necessarily what you wanted. And so trying to sort of understand what that means in a design context and its generative capacity to not think like you, right? So I think there's room in the design process if you're looking for something that can take the place of a creative team or at least begin to be that devil's advocate to subvert your preconceptions about a design concept. These models can do that. I was actually quite surprised the other day when I generated an image of a building. You could see some interior information through the windows from the outside. When I did a 2D to 3D, what's called a neural radiance field, basically having the model read edges and depth and try to actually generate something three-dimensional. When I opened that up into a CAD program and started to slice it and section and plan, there was actually an internal logic inside. Now, it didn't make much sense, but you can see that these tools, the more information you pump into them, the more they can start to do. And I think that's kind of an interesting idea in itself.
Well, thank you, Josh, for being here. That was really intellectually invigorating, and I appreciate your time.
It's my pleasure. I love talking about this stuff. So anytime, I'm happy to talk your head off.
That was Joshua Vermillion, architect and associate professor at UNLV's School of Architecture, talking to Nevada Public Radio's Scott Dickensheets. And this is Desert Air. the Best of Desert Companion magazine for your ears. And it's all done by the talented folks at Nevada Public Radio. You're able to hear this without ads because of listener support. You can find more on this story and how to keep others like it coming at knpr.org. I'm your host, Ann Davis. Thanks for listening.